Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Environmental Law and Property Rights Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, March 26, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on yesterday's Supreme Court oral arguments in Michigan v. EPA. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Assistant Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome Professor Jonathan Adler of the Case Western Reserve University School of Law. A more complete bio was provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for his presentation, followed by your questions. Professor Adler, the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you. Happy to talk about this case today, styled as Michigan versus EPA, also at times has been referred to as Utility Air Regulatory Group versus EPA or National Mining Association versus EPA, because there were quite a few petitions for certiorari filed by several different groups, three of which were accepted for the case that was heard yesterday by the court. The case involves a challenge to the Environmental Protection Agency's decision to regulate emissions of mercury as hazardous air pollutants when they are emitted from oil and coal-fired power plants under Section 112 of the Clean Air Act. This rule is, by all accounts, one of the costliest regulations in the Environmental Protection Agency's history, so it's no surprise that it has sparked significant controversy and litigation. And the particular issue in this case that the court accepted certiorari on is, and this phrasing of the question was of the court's own devising, it was not the phrasing that was suggested by any of the petitioners, is whether the Environmental Protection Agency unreasonably refused to consider costs in determining whether it is appropriate to regulate hazardous air pollutants emitted by electric utilities. And as that question suggests, the EPA, when deciding to regulate mercury emissions from power plants, concluded that it would not consider the costs of such regulation in making that threshold decision, and that is the primary basis upon which the rule is being challenged now. Just a little bit of background. First, it's just interesting to note that this is the third Clean Air Act case in the past 2 years heard by the Supreme Court. The court heard two a year ago. It heard the EME Homer City case, otherwise known as the Casper case, because it involved a challenge to the rule that was controlling cross-state air pollution. In that case, the Supreme Court upheld EPA's regulation by a vote of 6-2, with both the Chief Justice and Justice Kennedy joining the more liberal justices to uphold EPA's regulation there. And then the court also heard the case of UARG, or Utility Air Regulatory Group, versus EPA last term, involving a challenge to EPA's handling of greenhouse gas emission regulations under the Clean Air Act. There, the EPA got a split decision, losing 5-4 on the question of whether or not the EPA could adopt a tailoring rule and rewrite numerical thresholds in the statute to accommodate regulating greenhouse gases from stationary sources, but prevailing 7-2 on its ability to nonetheless reach most of such stationary source emissions of greenhouse gases. So last year, the EPA won one case and drew the other, got a draw in the other. The question is whether or not they will do as well here. As mentioned, this case is about EPA's decision to regulate mercury emissions from power plants under Section 112, finding and EPA's in particular its conclusion that it is, quote, appropriate and necessary to regulate such emissions. That is the standard the statute sets forth. The Obama administration, in making this determination, was effectively completing an effort begun under the Clinton administration. The Clinton administration, as it was leaving, issued a finding to trigger the regulation of mercury emissions from power plants, but that finding was then set aside by the Bush administration. That Bush administration action setting aside the finding was subsequently thrown out by the U.S. Court of Appeals by the D.C. Circuit, and then the Obama administration reinstituted the Clinton administration's finding that it would be appropriate and necessary to regulate mercury emissions. And the basis for that, that EPA gave is that it concluded that mercury emissions from power plants, despite the existence of other emission controls on power plants that are designed to control other types of emissions, that mercury emissions from power plants remain significant and pose a risk to public health, and that there are controls available that could be used to reduce such emissions. One thing that EPA said it would not consider is the potential cost of the regulation, and that's controversial because it's estimated that these regulations will cost approximately $9 billion, or $9.6 billion is the annual cost that has been suggested. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit upheld the EPA's rule 2-1. The majority of the D.C. Circuit panel that heard the case concluded that the word appropriate was sufficiently ambiguous that EPA could interpret it to preclude consideration of costs. Judge Brett Kavanaugh dissented from that portion of the D.C. Circuit opinion, and I would not be surprised if Judge Kavanaugh's dissent was one of the things that encouraged the court to accept cert in this case. There was no circuit split. This is the type of issue for which it's virtually impossible to have a circuit split because rules of national application promulgated under the Clean Air Act can only be challenged in the D.C. Circuit. The argument yesterday was slightly longer than normal. It was 90 minutes. It featured two-on-two. There were two advocates arguing on each side. Challenging the EPA rule, you had William Brownell representing the utility or regulatory group, basically representing the private industry petitioners. And you had Aaron Lindstrom, Solicitor General of the State of Michigan, on behalf of the state petitioners. And then defending the EPA, you had Solicitor General Donald Verrilli, who tends to take the most important and high-profile cases for the federal government, and then Paul Smith, representing a set of industry respondents defending the EPA rule. Some of the issues that came up in the oral argument that are worth highlighting, one is just the textual issue of how the phrase appropriate and necessary should be interpreted, whether it's a term should be seen as a term of art or whether each word needs to be have its own independent meaning. One of the arguments made by the petitioners is that insofar as EPA stressed the health effects and health risks of mercury emissions, it was really only giving meaning and import to necessary and not giving sufficient import to the word appropriate, and that one could not know if it's appropriate to take a given action if one doesn't know the consequences of that action, i.e., if you don't know the costs of regulating, you can't know whether it's appropriate to regulate. Solicitor General's response was generally that all that EPA needed to do to know that it was conclude that it was appropriate was its analysis that technology existed that could control emissions of mercury, and that that is what made it appropriate. In defending the EPA rule, one argument that came up repeatedly was the extent to which EPA should receive deference. That is, insofar as the word appropriate does not reveal a precise meaning and does not provide the agency with precise guidance, under Chevron, would EPA be due deference so long as it provided a reasonable interpretation? And there were some comments, including some early comments by Justice Kennedy, suggesting that the word appropriate is quite broad, is susceptible to a wide range of meaning, and that it might well be reasonable for EPA to focus on something like technological feasibility rather than cost in giving meaning to that. Another issue that came up that only made a brief appearance in the merits briefs but was developed more fully by at least one of the amici is this question of whether or not EPA can claim to have engaged in reasoned decision-making under State Farm if it failed to consider costs. And that's because generally under State Farm, it's understood that an agency to engage in reasoned decision-making must examine all the relevant aspects of a given problem. And if you're talking about the potentially costly regulation of something from power plants, that one cannot say to have considered all the relevant factors if one has not considered cost. Related to that, petitioners maintain that there is evidence that Congress was particularly concerned about the regulation of power plants because power plants provide electricity, because there's concern about reliability, because there's a recognition that power plants are often built many, or last for decades, and that it can be costly to retrofit them and so on, that it was reasonable to provide special protection for power plants from regulation. This argument was also heightened by the fact that, according to the petitioners, the cost of this rule, an estimated $9.6 billion annually, are wholly disproportionate to the benefits from mercury reductions, which are estimated to be around $6 million annually. And related to that, there was some discussion of whether or not it was appropriate, or it would be appropriate, for EPA to rely upon the existence of co-benefits from regulation. In particular, EPA's claim is that the technologies that would be used to control mercury emissions will also reduce emissions of other pollutants, and that the reduction of those pollutants will produce benefits on the order of anywhere between $37 and $90 billion, with a B, dollars per year. And there was some discussion, primarily at the instigation of Chief Justice Roberts, about whether or not it's fair to evaluate the decision to regulate mercury as a hazardous air pollutant based on benefits that are obtained from controlling other pollutants that are, incidentally, also subject to regulation under other provisions of the Clean Air Act. Another issue that came up that was certainly interesting was this question of whether an EPA could defend its decision because it has the ability to consider costs later in the process, that is, after making the initial threshold determination that it is appropriate to regulate mercury emissions. EPA then has the ability to consider costs in setting standards and in creating subcategories of emitting sources so as to potentially reduce the cost of compliance if there's a portion of emitters or a portion of power plants that would be disproportionately affected by such a rule. And then relates that if EPA could do that, is it a problem that EPA did not appear to have said that in the rulemaking? Chief Justice Roberts, again, raised several questions about whether or not some of the arguments that were being made in defense of EPA, and in particular being made by Justice Breyer about the ability to consider costs later and to subcategorize sources of emissions, whether or not they could be relied upon if they were not in the record upon which EPA made its decision. I'm loath to ever give predictions about cases, but let me just say a few things about that. One is the fact that the Supreme Court accepted cert in this case and there was no circuit split certainly gave supporters of the EPA cause for concern. It takes four justices to grant cert, and this did not look like the sort of case that the court would have accepted had there not been at least four justices that were quite skeptical of the decision below, and perhaps the EPA's rule, or at least from what they knew about it from the cert petitions. Also, because the specific issue in this case is about the interpretation of specific language that applies to a particular set of emission controls under the Clean Air Act, it doesn't on its face implicate broader questions of administrative law that would normally command the court's attention. That said, listening to the oral argument or reading the oral argument transcript and looking at the briefs, this case certainly could provide guidance for some broader questions that come up with some frequency in administrative law, such as the extent to which agencies should be expected to consider costs where they are not precluded from doing so, as well as what it really means to engage in reasoned decision-making when the authorizing statute does not provide specific guidance as to the inquiry that should be conducted. In terms of outcome, I think that the EPA probably felt pretty good about the defense made on its behalf yesterday. Having two advocates helps in the sense that allowing the second advocate to hear on the government side, hear all the three arguments up to that point and address his arguments to specific concerns that were raised earlier is certainly something that can be done quite effectively, and I think it was yesterday. In terms of what justices were thinking, Justices Sotomayor, Kagan, and Ginsburg seemed fairly clearly in the government's camp, fairly willing to defer to EPA's judgment. Justice Alito and Justice Scalia seemed quite skeptical of the federal government's arguments and of the EPA. The justices that would seem to be in play in this case would be First Justice Breyer, who, while he offered some arguments that could be used to defend the EPA's action, also noted his concern about the possibility that, regulatory costs could become excessive in relation to benefits, and in the past has suggested that as a default rule, agencies should be expected to consider costs if not conduct an actual cost-benefit analysis when making regulatory decisions. Chief Justice Roberts seemed quite skeptical of the government and certainly seemed posed some difficult questions about what arguments the government could rely upon in particular, but I think there were other comments of his that, suggest that he might well be in play, including some comments he made about the possibility of, EPA choosing either to consider costs or not consider costs based on EPA's interpretation of the word appropriate. As is so often the case, this decision may come down to Justice Kennedy. At different times in the argument, he seemed sympathetic to each side. Early on, he seemed somewhat hostile or asked some somewhat difficult or hostile questions to the petitioner's side, noting that and noted that appropriate would seem to be a very broad term that would be reasonably subject to EPA interpretation. But later on, he also noted when it was suggested that the EPA could address any concerns about costs by considering costs later in the process, he suggested that, would be too late. That really the whole game here, or the whole ball of wax, is determined by the threshold determination that additional regulation is appropriate, and that later consideration of costs really would not bring much to the table. And so we did not, I don't think we got a clear read on what Justice Kennedy is thinking, and he would certainly seem to be in play. It is worth remembering that both he and Justice Roberts did side with EPA in the cross-state air pollution rule case, EME Homer City, and in the latter part of the greenhouse gas case from last term. So they may be open to the EPA's arguments. I will pause there and see if there are questions.
Thank you, Professor. We will now open the floor request mode. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. Again, if you have a question, press star and then pound. While we wait to see if the audience queues up with their questions here, some commenters have pointed out the somewhat unusual lineup of parties in this case. Do you want to talk about that for a minute while we wait for questions?
Sure. So this case, you know, as might be befitting a rule that, again, by the conventional estimates, will impose $9.6 billion with a B dollars in costs per year. There are a lot of parties in addition to lots of amici. One of the things that's interesting about this case is you have industry groups on both sides of the case, as well as state groups on both sides. Seeing states on both sides of a high-profile case, especially an environmental case, is something that we've gotten used to. Generally, New England states and California and perhaps Pacific Northwest states tend to be more supportive of EPA regulation. Midwestern and Southern states tend to be more critical of EPA regulation, particularly when you have a regulation that implicates coal. You expect that kind of regional split. Something that's somewhat unique here, though, is the fact that there are industry groups on both sides as parties to the case. Again, no surprise that some utility groups and mining, the National Mining Association and coal companies would be challenging EPA's regulation here, but a group of power producers also are respondents in the case on EPA's side, and I think it was probably wise strategically for the EPA to give some of its argument time or to assent to there being argument time on behalf of pro-government industry respondents in this case, which makes this case not simply industry versus the Environmental Protection Agency, which is what we're more used to seeing. In some respects, it's industry versus industry, and that's because whether this FTC's action here is upheld, has big effects on quite a few industries and has variable competitive effects. That is to say, there are some companies that have already made investments in emission controls and would like to make sure that their competitors have to make equivalent investments, and on that basis are quite supportive of EPA regulation.
Well, this is a very thorough presentation from background facts through reading the tea leaves. We don't have any questions yet. One last call here. If you have a question, please do press star and the pound key.
You know, one thing I'll just add that was kind of interesting is the Chevron issues in this case are interesting, and whatever the court decides, it'll be interesting to see how it handles the Chevron question. Chief Justice Roberts asked the Solicitor General about whether or not it was EPA's position that the phrase appropriate and necessary precluded costs, or whether EPA's view was that it was ambiguous and therefore EPA could reasonably conclude or interpret it to preclude consideration of costs. And the Solicitor General said that EPA's position really was the latter. And so there's an interesting exchange in which the Solicitor General effectively acknowledged that it would have been reasonable for EPA to have adopted the alternative view. And you know, he said early on in his argument that the statutory text does not, and he doesn't think the statutory text unambiguously forbids EPA from considering costs. You know, that would certainly suggest that a future administration could take a different view. I would not expect that to happen, because once the capital expenditures are made on this type of regulation, utilities aren't going to undo those investments. But it is still interesting to see, because given that that's EPA's position, if EPA is to lose, it will either be because a majority of the court concludes that the phrase appropriate and necessary, and in particular the word appropriate, necessarily requires consideration of costs, given what the word appropriate means, or more likely that whether or not the statute is ambiguous or not, reasoned decision-making by the agency in this sort of context requires consideration of costs, in effect saying that an interpretation of the statutory language by EPA, which might be reasonable if all we're thinking about is the meaning of the words, is still unreasonable as an exercise of its rulemaking authority. And if the court were to go in that direction, that would be quite interesting.
We do have two questions on the line now, so we'll take the first of those.
David Emerson, Society member in Berkeley, California. Was there any discussion, either in the briefs or in the arguments, about the applicability of the regulation either as a go-forward or as applied to only new construction, where the cost-benefit analysis would be much more favorable, controllable, and manageable, versus having it applied to existing stationary capital infrastructure, and in particular, whether or not there was any kind of exigency factor here that would mitigate one way or another, because this has been apparently an ongoing situation and this continues to be ongoing. So an argument that it was necessary immediately could probably, you know, be justified, but if there's an estoppel argument to be made, that the construction was put in place, capital was sunk, and that there is a payback period, you could also argue the other way. So the general question is was the go-forward approach and only for new construction or existing construction as well?
Yeah, there are quite a few provisions of the Clean Air Act which are exclusively about new sources or newer modified sources, and you tend to get a slightly different regulatory dynamic when we grandfather in older facilities. This is not really that type of provision, and the effects of the regulation, is two things. One is Section 112 of the Clean Air Act separates out electric utility steam generating units, or what we refer to as EGUs, the units that are used for the generation of electricity at coal and oil and gas-fired power plants, to subject them to a separate study before the EPA could make a determination about regulating them. And there was discussion about what import should be given to Congress doing this. The EPA's argument is that the point of this was to just acknowledge the fact that these facilities are going to be regulated under a wide range of other portions of the Act, in particular Title IV, which is the portion of the Clean Air Act that deals with acid rain forming emissions. Congress didn't know whether or not, after all those controls were put in place, whether or not additional controls would be necessary. The petitioner's argument is that, no, this actually evinces more than that, a particular concern about power plants as being not so much in terms of new versus old, but in terms of power plants being the sort of emitting facility that we need to have some special concern for, because we are concerned about things like electric reliability and consumer costs, the cost of electricity to consumers and things like that. So that certainly came up. The idea, which EPA didn't really talk about in issuing the rule, but Justice Breyer talked a lot about in oral argument, which is that EPA has the ability to create subcategories. So here, the category is coal and oil-fired power plants, but that EPA could create a subcategory based on design or what have you of different plants, so as to treat plants differently from one another, and that certainly could be used in a way that effectively has the lines with the relative age of facilities, because you know different technologies were used at different times and so on. And so that issue was raised. The last thing that kind of relates to the question is that is in the background of this is you know, utilities complied with Title IV, the acid rain provisions of the Clean Air Act, but some utilities did that not by reducing their own emissions, but potentially by doing things like acquiring emission credits, tradable emission allowances. And so those facilities are likely to be more, you know, maybe more impacted more greatly by this rule, if it's upheld, than those facilities that directly made efforts to reduce their emissions. And so, and certainly utilities that have already invested in additional emission controls would like to see the rest of the industry subject to similar requirements.
After we take this next question, our lines will be open. If you'd like to join the question queue, please hit star and then the pound key.
Hi, John. It's John Shepherd from Skadden. I keep hearing about these remarks that Breyer made at oral argument, and meaning to listen to the tape, that would have effectively manufactured some better reasons why EPA could have sustained its rule. Please tell me that he or someone pointed out that there's a post hoc rationalization problem going on there.
Yes.
Sneak this in under like some reasonable reading under Chevron that was not offered, or does he recognize these limits? That I'm a little bit worried about that.
Yeah, no, I think it's a real concern. Generally, Chief Justice Roberts in particular, but I don't believe he was the only one. But Chief Justice Roberts in particular did raise the issue about, you know, whether or not these arguments were in the record. So Justice Breyer talked about the extent to which EPA might be, even if it didn't consider costs in making the threshold determination, could consider costs later on by, among other things, creating subcategories of sources so as to effectively create differential emission reduction requirements for different types of sources, different subcategories of sources within the universe of coal-fired power plants. And at one point in the oral argument says something to the effect of, well, you know, EPA didn't come up with this, but we came up with this in chambers, or something like that. But the Chief Justice, I don't remember who else may have raised this, but the Chief Justice did raise the concern that something like this would need to be in the record. I suppose the argument that would be made in defense of EPA on this point is that insofar as the statute clearly provides the authority to do things like create subcategories, and insofar as costs could be used for that, perhaps EPA could argue that they're not required to state the obvious or to restate what the Act provides for in the rulemaking process. I think the question then becomes whether or not it is necessary for the EPA to say, we didn't consider costs now, but we can consider them later in order to uphold their decision, the reasonableness of their decision, or is it sufficient for EPA to simply say, we read appropriate and necessary to not require consideration of costs. We think the best reading of it is to not require and perhaps even to preclude consideration of costs. That's our position. Just as the National Ambient Air Quality Standard provisions don't allow consideration of costs, we don't think this provision does. And so the interesting thing about Breyer's question is it seemed, Justice Breyer likes cost-benefit analysis, and it appeared to me, at least, that he wanted to be assured that just because EPA didn't consider cost in making this determination, it could consider costs at a later date if needed to prevent disproportionate effects.
This later date, is this on remand, or is this later date on in some different rulemaking? Because
in a subsequent rulemaking,
later date on remand is going to do nothing to prevent several gigawatts of coal-fired generation from being shut out of the PJM.
At some later date in making a subsequent decision to create subcategories. Precisely when that would occur, not so sure. I know that those exchanges, there were a couple exchanges where this hypothesis of Breyer's came up, and I think, whether or not, if Breyer were to conclude, and Breyer's probably one of the justices in play here, if Breyer believes that cost has to be considered at some point, then his argument is problematic because EPA probably needed to say that to explain its decision in that way. That is to say, EPA needed to say it's reasonable for us not to consider cost now because we will consider cost later. If, on the other hand, this is like Whitman versus American Trucking, and this is just the context in which cost just doesn't play a role, and EPA can just look at health risks and feasibility, or the existence, I shouldn't even say feasibility, the existence of emission control technology without regard for its cost, then the ability to consider cost later is irrelevant, right? That is to say, if EPA's interpretation of the language is reasonable under Step 2 of Chevron and satisfies State Farm, then who cares if it can consider cost later? So, I wasn't quite sure whether to read Breyer's argument as something that he was just trying to do to convince himself, or where he's just pointing out, look, this is the way the statute works. It's not a problem. We can the provision can be interpreted this way. And I'm not entirely, while if I had to bet, I would say he seems inclined to side with EPA. He said some things in argument that might dissuade him from that.
Thanks. Finally, is this going to be an end of June decision, do you think, or sometime sooner? I ask because most of the major auctions that are going to depend on capacity forwards they're going to be taking place in May.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I assume given everything else the court has to do, and given the number of decisions that have yet to be issued, and that given that we're at the end of March, I don't see how they get this out before June. Unless they agree on some very narrow grounds, right? If they just decide to send this back to EPA for lack of reasoned decision making, that's something they could do relatively quickly. And of course, if that's what they did, we'd probably get a virtually identical result just 2 years from now. But I would expect this. This may not be the last week of June, but I would assume this is June.
Well, seeing no additional questions, Professor, do you want to offer any concluding remarks?
As I mentioned before, it is interesting that the court has yet another Clean Air Act case after having two last term. This was not a case many observers thought the court was going to take. The court is likely to be divided 5-4 or 6-3 in the end on this case. And while it's hard to determine whether or not this case will have broader applications beyond the specifics of this particular regulation, this particular regulation is a big one. It is expected to cost $9.6 billion per year and generate, if you're just focusing on mercury benefits, several million dollars a year, or if you think it's acceptable to consider the co-benefits, tens of billions of benefits per year. So it's the magnitude of this decision in economic terms is significant, even if it's not clear whether the legal rule itself will be significant. So close with that.
Well, thank you, Professor, for joining us. Thanks, everyone, who dialed in today. Our next Teleforum call will take place tomorrow at 1 p.m. That's on the new NLRB representation case rule. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.